Today is Tuesday, October 24th. We're going to be working on the intestines today. Okay. On the bottom of page 86, let's talk about the summary of stomach's activities. We were really just kind of getting into this during the last few minutes of class on Thursday of last week. So we know that mechanical digestion in the stomach is actually wave-like peristalsis contractions. The only kind of chemical breakdown or hydrolysis is the one that involves proteins being broken into their building blocks or monomers. So what are some of the enzymes that help to break down proteins in the stomach? Yeah, hydrochloric acid, pepsin, and there's one more. It helps to break down milk proteins. Renin. Yeah, so you're right. Hydrochloric acid helps to degrade proteins. Pepsin is an enzyme that helps to hydrolyze or break protein polymers into monomers. And we've also got renin that helps to break down milk proteins into amino acids. You know, not a lot going on here in terms of absorption. The stomach is not really built for absorption. It's more of a site for breaking that food down mechanically. So the absorption here is limited to alcohol and aspirin, two things that can, if taken on an empty stomach, hit your bloodstream rather quickly. We know that aspirin also can be coated with what they call an enteric coating. It's like a sugar coating, because aspirin by itself is a pretty harsh acid, and it can degrade your stomach's lining. So that's why a lot of those aspirins in the grocery store or pharmacy actually have a sugar coating on the outside. It's meant to protect that lining of your stomach. I thought you'd be interested in seeing how peristalsis works, so let me show you a quick video. So that is the pyloric sphincter. That's the direction we're looking in the stomach. And the wave of peristalsis is fairly slow, but I think you'll watch it. Here it comes down. And it's amazing you don't feel that. You know, all that movement's going on in your stomach and you don't feel it. You're not aware of it at all. Like a very slow tidal wave, isn't it?
So
it
just is like a rolling?
Like a rolling, yeah.
So how do they get that? How do they get it to do that without food in there? Or are they breathing?
It's an endoscopic view, and maybe they had some kind of chemical that turned on the waves there. Acetylcholine would do it, so. It perhaps might have been something like that. Yeah, that is a pretty neat thing to watch. So on the top of the next page, let's talk about some of the control for the stomach. Blank at the bottom, alcohol and aspirin are probably your blanks. So if you do have a blank at the very bottom of page 86, it's probably for alcohol and aspirin. Okay, top of page 87, you'll notice that we're going to talk about control of the stomach's activities. And control comes in two forms. Part of the control is neural, using the vagus nerve. And part of the control is, of course, you know, the hormone gastrin, which helps to turn on the release of stomach juices. So, you know, we talked about ways to make your stomach start to churn, and one of those ways to simply discuss having something to eat. If you talk about food, smell food, taste food, or even eat food, these are all things that can turn on the vagus nerve's control. The vagus nerve encourages the release of gastrin from those stomach cells called enteroendocrine cells. Okay. So let's talk about the three phases. You know, if you're in a parasympathetic frame of mind, then your stomach is going to be ready to digest food. What do you think sympathetic frame of mind does to your stomach's activities.
It shuts it off.
Yeah, shuts it off. So if you're stressed, if you're upset, if you're emotional, those kinds of feelings are going to shut down stomach activities. So yeah, we're looking at parasympathetic control, vagus nerve, turning on gastrin. So the first phase of getting your stomach ready for food is what we call a cephalic phase. This is your head in control of your stomach. And you know, you've often heard the phrase mind over matter. Well, in this case, it's mind over stomach. So if you think about food, smell food, taste food, these kinds of things are going to start to activate the release of gastrin. What cranial nerve tells those enteroendocrine cells to release gastrin?
Vagus.
Good. So vagus nerve tells enteroendocrine cells to release gastrin. And when gastrin is released, it tells parietal cells to release what two chemicals?
Hydrochloric acid?
Intrinsic factor, that's it. And so what does intrinsic factor help you absorb?
B12,
good.
Yeah.
And hydrochloric acid is necessary for?
Breaking pepsin into pepsin.
Good, turn pepsinogen into pepsin. And hydrochloric acid makes your stomach pH around?
One or two.
Yeah, pretty acidic.
Yeah.
Okay. So the blank there on your sheet is for the vagus nerve to stimulate the release of gastrin. Vagus nerve.
Can you go over that one more time?
Sure.
This is what?
So if you think about food, taste it, smell it, that turns on the vagus nerve. Vagus nerve turns on gastrin. Gastrin tells your it comes from your enteroendocrine cells. It travels through the bloodstream and targets your parietal cells, tells them to release two chemicals. Hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. And so hydrochloric acid reduces your pH and helps you convert pepsinogen into pepsin. Yeah, and intrinsic. Yeah, bottom of that page 86, and intrinsic factors for
B12. Yeah. And does intrinsic factor anything to do
with? Totally different things, yeah. No relationship there.
Pepsin is to break down
proteins, yeah. So in the video that we just watched of peristalsis waves in the stomach, they could have simply talked to that person, you know, before they put them to sleep about food, and that could have been enough to activate those peristalsis waves. So simply getting your mind in the right frame is something that can make the stomach start to churn and grind. And, you know, if your stomach is grinding and there's air in there, then that air makes a growling noise as it's propelled towards your duodenum. So if you can get the air out of your system, then, of course, that growling noise is not quite so obnoxiously loud, right? All right, so once you actually start eating, you're now going to move into what's called the gastric phase, or in other words, the stomach phase. And so when you've got food in the stomach begins to encourage further chemicals. So why do you want more chemicals to be released when food is in the stomach?
Break
down the food that's there, right? So this next phase, gastric phase, encourages us to release more chemicals into the stomach. All right, and then finally, when you've finished your meal, you've pushed away from the table, you're done, you know, you're no longer interested in eating, your stomach is now full of food that will take somewhere between 4 and 6 hours to empty. Now we're in what's called an enteric phase, or an intestinal phase, and there's a reflex that occurs here called the enterogastric reflex. This reflex is going to push peristalsis waves back at the stomach. So what are we trying to prevent the stomach from doing very quickly? You don't want the stomach just to open that pyloric sphincter and do what with all that food?
Push it all out,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So the point of this phase is to tell the stomach, hey, not so fast. You know, you're full of maybe a half of a gallon of food. Don't send it down to the small intestine, but oh so slowly. Why do we not want food to come barreling into the small intestine all at once? Right, won't absorb the nutrients, you won't mix it with those enzymes. So what we're trying to do during this third phase is tell the stomach, hey, you know, slow it down So the waves actually go in reverse back toward the stomach, telling the stomach to stop emptying so quickly. In fact, during this reflex, we're going to see the small intestine receive about 3 milliliters of food at a time. If you've ever heard your intestine squirting, you know, little squirty noises after you've had a meal, and somebody might have said to you, "Are you still hungry?" You say, "Oh no, that's just me digesting." You've ever had that conversation? Okay, what you're probably hearing is the squirting of about 3 milliliters of food at a time through your pyloric sphincter. And yeah, if there's air in there, you're going to hear squirting noises coming along with that. So there is a hormone here, GIP. We've talked about it before. GIP is gastrin-inhibiting peptide, and it's going to tell the stomach to not release what?
Gastrin.
Gastrin, right. If you shut off gastrin, you then shut off the release of hydrochloric acid. Now, what happens to your stomach pH?
Come back up,
yeah. So instead of being like 1 or 2, your stomach pH rises to like 3 or 4. So that's not really great for the conversion of what into what? Good. Yeah, pepsinogen into pepsin, right? So by the time you finished your food, your stomach pH is going to start to increase. And so that allows for us to kind of slow down, put the brakes on what the stomach is doing. All right. So you can see the J-shaped curve of the stomach here allows for food to sit mostly in that pyloric region. In fact, that's where the most of our gastric glands are located, is down in that gastric, or what they call the gastric antrum, down here in the pyloric area. Okay. And so it does take around 4 to 6 hours to empty the stomach's contents when you're full. And if you're looking with me on your worksheet, that's down there near the bottom of your page. Gastric motility and emptying. The stomach usually empties within around 4 to 6 hours of a meal. And you'll notice there's another blank for us to fill in. What types of meals will slow the emptying of the stomach? Protein, good. That's definitely one. Yeah, fibrous foods can make you feel full. The obvious one is a big meal, right? A big meal is going to take longer to empty. And one more, a fatty meal. So protein-enriched, a fibrous meal, a fatty meal, and a big meal all can be things that slow the emptying of your stomach. So it's interesting that if you go to the grocery store and you walk the breakfast aisle, it's almost entirely full of carbohydrates and sugars. And the problem with the carb or sugar is it's easily broken down by your stomach, and your stomach empties it rather quickly. So a bowl full of cereal for breakfast may not last you more than 30 minutes or an hour, and then you start feeling like, you know, I should eat something again. So the problem is we end up eating more calories than may be necessary to sustain our basal metabolic rate during the day. You can eat a comparable amount of calories that come from protein, and because proteins are bigger molecules and harder to break down, you'll stay full longer and in the long run consume less calories. So, you know, if you eat something like an egg or a protein-enriched breakfast, then that may keep you full for hours as opposed to, say, maybe an hour or two from just something like a grain or a cereal. So we often feel more satisfied when we have fat in our meal, and the reason for that is it's the very last thing to be emptied from our stomachs. And it, in fact, floats on the top portion, just like grease in a sink, and it becomes the very last thing to be emptied when your stomach flushes out its contents. So, you know, that's part of the reason that we feel satiated from fatty foods is it gives us a full feeling for a little longer than normal. All right, so that should take us near the bottom of your page. How about questions so far?
Can you go back to the slide that you just had up there so I can take a picture?
Sure, is it
next one. Next one, this, yeah,
that one. That one, okay.
Did we come over that?
We're actually going to talk about that one in just a few minutes, more related to bile and gallbladder secretions.
Will we need to know the stomach disorders for the case?
No, but I'm going to show you a couple of them just for fun. Let's see, near the bottom of your page, this is bottom of 87, just wanted to mention something called gastritis. That itis ending means what?
Inflammation,
right. So you may have gastritis from, say, a virus, a bacterial infection. You may have gastritis from something that just you feel like didn't agree with you. So it's a catch-all term that simply means there's inflammation of the stomach lining. So we may not know what the underlying reason is. It could be food poisoning for all we know. But when we have gastritis and we have an upset stomach that makes us vomit, which is reverse peristalsis, brat. So what are we avoiding by eating a brat diet?
Harsh. Stuff that's hard to digest.
Hard to digest, right. And very importantly, you'll notice that we're avoiding milk products because milk products tend to make your stomach secrete more mucus. So if you have, say, a milkshake after having had a recent bout of vomiting, that just irritates that stomach lining further and may make you sick to your stomach once again. So we avoid cream soups, milk products, cheeses, dairy after you've had, say, a bout of vomiting. So that brat diet, you're right, is an easy thing to help digest. I want to mention various types of gastric bypass surgeries. This is what we classically call gastric bypass, and you'll notice that in the picture, they've taken off a piece of the stomach and created a teeny tiny new pouch, and the rest of the stomach is left intact inside the body, and it's still hooked into the small intestine. So the cruel thing is, this big piece of stomach here still thinks it's going to get food. So when you think about food, when you're eating food, it's still going to growl. It's still going to start churning as if it was going to be fed. And it takes some number of weeks for that pouch to realize it's no longer part of the game. So
eventually, like, just die off?
It doesn't die off, but it just eventually learns to stop responding since there's no food coming to it. So it's kind of a sad letdown, you know.
So they'll just leave that in there?
They'll leave that in there.
Well, I guess it wouldn't.
Yeah, it's got blood supply, yeah. This little pouch that's left behind holds around a baby jar amount of food, about 3 ounces. And yeah, that is muscular, so it can stretch back and get more, you know, more food in there. You know, unfortunately, if you do eat large meals, that can cause weight gain. Now, the problem with this, you've cut off the majority of your stomach. So what kinds of nutrients are we not as capable of breaking down?
Proteins,
good. What vitamin are we less likely to absorb?
B12,
exactly. So we got to watch for things like vitamin B12 intake to avoid pernicious anemia and make sure that we get enough proteins through some route to get those amino acids.
How would that, like, affect, like, you're obviously not getting much food, and whenever you're a bigger person, it takes a lot more energy keep your body running. How would that, like, affect, like, blood sugar and all that stuff? Like, I feel like you would be extremely, like, lethargic after that.
It's going to be an adjustment, yeah, because you're not getting the nutrients that you're used to getting. And so your body's going to then rely on the breakdown of the fat. So it has to learn to consume the fat and the proteins out of your body rather than relying on what it's getting from the stomach. So there's going to be a time period there of adjustment where you don't feel so hot until the body learns that that's where the energy is coming from, not the stomach, but rather, you know.
I feel like that's not healthy either.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously,
it's usually
the first
done
in a diet
situation.
Right.
Like, it's usually only done if your obesity is truly that bad. Like, if you're going to die from your weight and there's a way that they can fix it, that would be the way that they do it. It's usually the last recommended thing because the amount of medication that you have to take, the adjustment time is a lot longer. There's so many things that can happen to it, but that's usually like a last cause. Like, it's basically the better of the lesser of the evil.
And don't you have to have like a huge weight loss before you can get a surgery like that?
Not so much a huge weight loss. It depends on where your weight range is. If you're anything above 500, then of course it's dangerous.
Well,
but if you're somewhere between that 500 to 400 line, you're usually qualified for that.
Like, I've seen like the most six my whole life, whatever, and they always put them on like this drastic diet before they can actually, like, they have to lose like 120
pounds. The diet is usually to help them adjust to that lifestyle. It's usually for that mental change because it won't change anything and it'll still be even more detrimental if they have that mental thing like, I can still eat what I want. Like, that's what the diet is put in place for, is to help you adjust mentally.
So, but they have a different, they have the lap band too, right?
They have a lap band too. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And is that like, do they like shrink the stomach and let the rest of the stomach like naturally shrink back and then take a lap band off afterwards? Or like, how does that work?
I think
feel like you'd still be hungry after all that went through.
I think they probably have a weight loss goal. And yeah, you're right. After a certain period of time, once they get the weight to a certain goal, yeah. You had a sleeve, right?
Do you have a picture of that?
I don't have a sleeve. No, I sure don't. Yes. Yeah.
The
doctor can control it.
Instead of being cut the way that you saw the bypass, they actually have to move the intestine for that. With the sleeve, they don't have to move the intestine at all. They're only cutting out the part of the fundus and the curvature, like the greater curvature.
Right.
They're cutting that whole piece off. They're not even worrying about rearranging anything. There is no true bypass. It just makes it look like a sleeve.
Interesting. Yeah.
You can still hold less money, but you hold more than what you would with the bypass, and you hold less than what you would with the lap band. So it's like the good medium.
It's the Goldilocks place
yeah.
to be.
This is just right.
And they still leave the extra
fungus? Yeah, that one. Like, they're able to take out a big piece because it's not as much as when they take off from the bypass.
Not quite as dangerous, I guess, in terms of removal. Yeah.
I'll
have to put one into my PowerPoint. Yeah.
Like, I had to watch the whole procedure being done just so I could know what it was.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they made me watch all of them because they were like, before you pick one, we want you to know what exactly you're picking, what the side effects you're picking, what exactly you want your goal to be. Like, do you want to be detrimentally smaller but with a lot of side effects? Do you want to be smaller but at a healthy weight, which is what I'm doing now? Or do you want to do the lap band? The lap band is usually not the best because even though it helps temporarily, it does come out. And if you haven't changed mentally, you just basically gain the weight back. And
exactly.
More, so.
Well, that's interesting to have options like that. It's good.
And that's the only reason why I know as much as I do about this stomach because they make me want to all of that.
Well, that's that way you come in as an informed patient of what you want to, you own your health care that way.
They even have sleep numbers for it.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. One last thing about the stomach I did want to introduce to you, Helicobacter pylori. It's a bacterium that can ride in your stomach lining. And 70% of us are walking around with Helicobacter and have no problems with it. It is a very common bacterium. You can get it from drinking out of water fountains. It is something that's just very common in the environment.
H. pylori.
And if you take micro after this class, I'll talk about it in there. In some people, though, it can cause an infection, and that infection creates an ulcer in the lining of your stomach. Now, of course, that introduces bleeding into the stomach, and likewise, acids can now mix with the blood and enter the bloodstream. So this can become a very dangerous situation if you've got this particular bacterium and it's actively producing an infection. It can be diagnosed through either an upper GI biopsy or it can be diagnosed through a blood test, and then they can administer an antibiotic in case of an infection with this one. So used to, they would think that ulcers came from a stressful work environment, that you were too stressed out. But nowadays we know that ulcers more have to do with the infection of Helicobacter pylori than, say, a very stressful situation. So pretty interesting stuff.
And I recommend my diet for that also.
I imagine that would be helpful, yeah. And no milk to irritate that stomach. Looks like a canker sore, doesn't it? All right. So that should take us down to the bottom of 87. How about questions so far? All right, let's talk about small intestine. Why do they call it a small intestine?
Smaller than the large one.
But in terms of length, how does it compare to your large intestine?
Oh, it's much longer.
Much longer, right. In a cadaver, they measure it. It's about 20-some feet in length. That's pretty long. In a living person, we have muscle tone, so it's shrunk up not quite as long as 20 feet. But nonetheless, even at 20 feet, we need all the help we can get in increasing the surface area to maximize absorption. So when we talk about the regions, duodenum, duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. The one closest to the stomach actually has the most modifications to maximize surface area. So let's talk about those modifications for increasing surface area. The first one is villi or a villus. Each villus has its own microvilli. And then we also have circular folds that are like speed bumps in the small intestine. So you're looking at a villus. This is a finger-like extension of the small intestine lining. And this individual villus has its own supply of blood vessels. You'll notice inside we have a capillary, and we also have another vessel called a lacteal. The capillary is helping to pick up nutrients and fluids. The lacteal also helps to pick up nutrients and fluids. Now, let me distinguish between the two. The capillary belongs to the cardiovascular system. The lacteal belongs to the lymphatic system. Both are going to take your fluids back to what organ?
Your heart.
Back to your heart. Good. So inside, you do have quite a network of vessels here to pick up these fluids and nutrients. You'll notice that we're looking at mostly simple columnar epithelium, and there's some goblet cells embedded in here as well. And those goblet cells secrete mucus to help lubricate the passage of food. When we kind of zoom out and look at this picture, you'll see what looks to be these extensions, almost like a finger-like extension of the small intestine lining. They call this a brush border appearance, because if you look at it with your naked eye, it looks kind of like the surface of your tongue. So you see a bunch of the little bumps there from the tops of those villi. In between each of these villi are spaces called crypts, and that's where enzymes hang out and help us to break down food in the small intestine. So let's take a closer look at a single villus. Right here is a single villus. You'll notice that there are even smaller projections that come off of that single villus. What are those tinier projections called?
Microvilli.
Microvilli, good. And what are they there for?
Increased
surface area, right. What do we need more surface area for?
Absorption.
Good. I've had students tell me in the past these look like little trees, like maybe pine trees. And so you can see that there's lots of increased area here for us to absorb nutrients. And there's a great amount of space here for us to mix the nutrients that have come into the small intestine. Yeah, that is a circular fold. Yeah, right there. That's a great shot. Yep, and so let's talk about those. There is a circular fold. It's basically a collection of villi linked together. These are also to help us increase surface area, but also to help us slow down the passage of food through our small intestine. Do you know about how long it takes for food to travel through the small intestine?
Hours.
Yep. About 3 to 6. Okay, so if you're looking at 4 to 6 hours in the stomach, you're only looking at 3 to 6 in the small intestine. So those plicae circulaire or circular folds actually slow down the passage of food, giving us enough time to absorb nutrients. All right, so middle of your page there, I just wanted to mention that we're pumping about 1 liter or 2 of fluids into your small intestine. That does help us maximize absorption. And the pH of the intestinal fluids pumped in here are about 7.4 to 7.8. There's something very important about that range. What also is a range of around 7.4?
Blood.
Yeah. So if you were to take stomach acid with a pH of 1 or 2 and absorb it directly into the bloodstream with a pH of, say, 7.4,
that'd be bad.
That'd be bad, yeah. So we got to neutralize it, and that's what this intestinal fluid does. That's why it tends to be around what this blood pH is. Okay, so in terms of movement here, you know, we're moving food through fairly quickly, you know, 3 to 6 hours to move about 20 feet. So that's a pretty fast clip that we're moving at. But we actually have a process here that helps to slow down the movement of the food through, and that's called segmentation. So segmentation is a special process that occurs only in the small intestine, and I describe it as a washing machine effect. Food is moved forward a bit, it's moved backward a bit, And this helps us to mix the food with enzymes in the small intestine. And most importantly, it helps us to slow down the passage of food. What does that help us maximize?
Absorption.
Absorption, yeah. So it's all about absorption. How is peristalsis different from segmentation?
It doesn't do a washing machine effect,
right? Peristalsis, like you saw in those waves, are rolling the food along toward the next organ, but segmentation is kind of a movement back and forth. I've got a video for you there.
Yes.
And the cool thing is, if you move your mouse along as if to do a fast motion through the video, you actually get a sense of segmentation. Let me increase it in size. See how that looks like, you know, beads on a string? Those are the little segments of your small intestine, mm-hmm. and the arrow is showing us the food actually moving backwards,
mm-hmm.
and then again it moves forward. So you kind of see it kind of migrating back and forth in that area of the small intestine.
Okay, so for like first question.
Okay.
And they're saying you're supposed to have like 2 to 3 bowel movements a day, right? That's like normal.
That depends on the person.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's like not a time in the day to do this 3 or 4 times.
No.
Right.
Yeah, they say it totally depends on your diet. It depends on the person. It depends on your routine. So what may be normal for one person may be completely abnormal for somebody else.
They said that it was shocking for me to have a bowel movement as quick as I did after the surgery.
Oh, wow.
Like, they said that as soon as you usually leave the hospital, I left out a lot later than most people. You're supposed to leave, like, the day after. I had over the weekend, so I left after, like, 4 to 5 days. I didn't even use the bathroom.
Wow.
So after about a week that I was gone, I went to see my doctor at, like, a month after. And I told him that by the 3rd week, I was able to use the bathroom normally. He was like, solid? I was like, yeah.
Wow.
So,
wow. I guess to other people maybe takes longer for their system to acclimatize.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It was an excitement that I got to do it one time a day. The normal was like 3. I was like, oh, no, I don't think I can.
No, that's too much time. Yeah. This is the organ to do absorption, but in order to do absorption, you've got to have your nutrients in a small enough form to absorb them into the bloodstream. So that's why we see a lot of chemical digestion taking place here in the small intestine. And one food group we have not yet treated with anything is the fat food group. So you'll notice that we've got the chemical digestion of fats. We do break them down using lipase and bile. We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. And we've also got not only intestinal enzymes, but also pancreatic enzymes that contribute to the breakdown of all of our food groups. Like I mentioned, this is the place where we absorb our nutrients. This is the last stop. So you want to make sure that what you're doing here is going to contribute to the absorption of those foods. All right. So why don't we take a tour of absorption, and we'll start over on page 89. Before we head there, do you have questions on anything we've covered so far?
What did you say about fat? Because I was trying that thing already.
That's okay. Fats are this is the first time we've really talked about breaking them down. So we not only break down fats and prepare them for absorption, but we in fact have enzymes that do all of our food groups. So this is the last stop for absorption, so we have to make sure everybody is ready to go into the bloodstream. All right, going way back to Bio-210. You guys probably remember there's 4 food groups, right? Carbs, lipids, proteins, nucleic acids. So let's talk about each of these food groups. We know the carbs are chewed up by the mouth, and there's also an enzyme in your mouth that helps you to break down carbs. What is that enzyme?
Salivary amylase.
Yeah, salivary amylase. Salivary amylase breaks your starches in your mouth into simple sugars, but the job is incomplete. The stomach doesn't really contribute any chemical breakdown of, say, starches and carbs, so our job to complete those breakdown products occurs here in the small intestine. You'll notice that the small intestine secretes its own enzymes, And we also receive enzymes that come from the pancreas. Notice that each of these terms here ends in A-S-E. What does that remind us of?
Enzymes.
I'm an enzyme. Good. So A-S-E is I'm an enzyme. You know, each one of these has a prefix. Amyl means starch. You've got maltase that breaks down maltose. We've got sucrase that breaks down, you got it, sucrose. And what about lactase? Breaks down lactose, right.
So people who are lactose intolerant don't produce lactase?
They don't produce lactase, or not enough, yeah. So when we're talking about breakdown here, I just want to emphasize we're doing a hydrolysis reaction that takes a polymer of some type of carb, breaks it down using water into its individual building blocks or monomers. So I just want to emphasize, when we're talking about digestion in the small intestine, that's mostly what we mean here, is the ability to break down these food particles into their monomers or building blocks. Proteins are also broken down in the stomach, but we complete the process here in the small intestine. What are some of the enzymes that help to contribute to breaking down proteins in the stomach?
Renin.
Renin and pepsin, good. What specifically does renin break down?
Milk.
Milk, good. And so what pH environment is necessary for pepsin to be active?
Acidic.
Acidic, yeah, very acidic. So once you get here into the small intestine, we're going to neutralize the chyme or the digested food coming in. So we're now working at a more neutral pH, one that's more relative to what blood pH is going to be. Now we're going to finish the process of hydrolyzing or breaking the polymers of proteins into monomers. We do that using some pancreatic enzymes called trypsin and chymotrypsin. Let me introduce these syn words. We've already talked about pepsin, and now we've got trypsin and chymotrypsin. So if you keep that straight in your mind, those syn words are the ones that have to do with breaking down your proteins into what?
Amino acids.
Amino acids, good. These syn words help us break down proteins. It's like going back to that old stuff, right? Into amino acids, that's right. Okay, so notice carb digestion begins in the mouth. It's completed in the small intestine. Protein digestion, and I mean specifically hydrolysis here, begins in the stomach. It's completed where?
In the small intestine.
Small intestine, right. Lipid digestion begins in very small amounts in the mouth, so small that we don't even talk about it when we discuss the mouth. But there are tiny amounts of an enzyme called lipase produced by your mouth. It's such a small amount that it's not even really worth our discussion, so we save our discussion of fats until we reach the small intestine. Now, there's two things here that help us to break down or hydrolyze fats. One is a chemical called bile, and the other is lipase. So let me explain the difference here. Lipase is an enzyme. Like other enzymes, it helps to hydrolyze fatty molecules into their building blocks. Now, bile, you'll notice, is not an enzyme. It's called an emulsifier. So if you've ever seen commercials for Dawn dishwashing liquid, their tagline is always that Dawn breaks up the grease. Okay? That's what bile does. Bile takes greasy molecules in your stomach and small intestine, and it actually takes bigger globs and breaks them into smaller, more manageable pieces. Once bile emulsifies those fats into smaller, more manageable pieces, lipase can come along and hydrolyze those fats into their building blocks. So what if you don't have enough bile in your small intestine? Can lipase do its job? Not without the bile, right. So how do we know this? By simply looking at, say, someone's stool or feces?
Fatty.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So someone who consistently has floaters may in fact have problems getting enough bile into their small intestine to break down those fatty molecules. So, you know, there's a lot you can learn from looking at someone's feces about their otherwise digestive health. So, yeah, if you don't have enough bile, your feces aren't broken down properly, or the fat's not broken down properly, the fat leaves in the feces, rather than being hydrolyzed by lipase and then moved into the bloodstream through absorption.
That's a good question. When a person has their gallbladder removed and they eat fatty foods, it's like...
Yeah, it's a bad
thing. Exactly. It's a straight train through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is corn indigestible?
Yeah, there's cellulose on the walls. We do not have the enzyme cellulase, so yeah, it passes through undigested.
I was just like,
so there's no nutritional
value in corn? Not in the walls, but in the starch inside the corn kernel there is. But the walls themselves are like lettuce leaves. You just can't break it down. So you just pass it through completely undigested. It's fiber. Yeah.
My sister, she came out the bathroom and she was appalled. She was like, why did all my cord leak?
Yep.
She said that it was the funniest thing. Like, I couldn't answer because I didn't know why. It leaves out the same way it comes in. Well, not exactly the same, but it's just funny. I was like, why is that?
Yeah, cows have the enzyme. We do not, so... Imagine if we could take cellulase, we could break down all sorts of things. We could break down leaves, we could break down corn walls, yeah. Pretty cool. So we normally don't talk about nucleic acids. You know, we talk about them as, you know, an organic compound, but we've never talked about them as a food group or a nutritional group. But, you know, I kind of want to change your thinking about them because even though they're not listed on a package of food as a nutritional item, you are what you eat. So if you eat corn, you get corn DNA. If you eat, say, cow or pig, you get the DNA from that animal. Whatever you're eating is going to give you the DNA or RNA molecules from that organism. You bring those molecules into your body through digestion, and then you break down those molecules into nucleotides using nucleases. We then absorb those nucleotides into our bloodstream, and we in turn turn those nucleotides into our own ATP molecules, RNA, DNA. So, you know, we actually do use the nucleotides from other organisms to build our own molecules inside. So kind of a cool concept there. All right, last thing on the bottom of the page, four vitamins here are listed as fat soluble. They're ADEK, A, D, E, and K. Because they are fat soluble, you should take them with food. If you're taking vitamin supplements and you're taking them on an empty stomach, well, there's no fat on an empty stomach or just a glass of water to help you maximize absorption. You pee them all out, exactly. So they're not going to be absorbed into your bloodstream as readily as they could.
And that's why your pee's like neon yellow if you take vitamins and have supplements.
Yeah, because... Yep, you're not getting the max. You're just basically taking them and dumping them in the toilet. Yeah.
That would explain some. They gave me vitamin D. And at first, it was just like one a month. And then they changed it and they gave me like four. Then they take one for every week and take for 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sure. I thought because I took all my other vitamins without food that I could find.
Yep, that one's definitely for fats. Some medications that people take say on the label to take with food, and the reason for that is they too are fat soluble, and if they're fat soluble, then you're going to maximize the absorption of your medicine if you take it with food. If you routinely take your medications without food and they tell you to take them with food or milk, then you may not be absorbing them as readily, and you may actually be getting a lower dose into your bloodstream than if you took them with food. So kind of an interesting thing there, you know, that actually drives what is absorbing those molecules. So some medications may say, you know, take with a glass of water. They are like the B and C vitamins that are water soluble and don't need the fat to maximize their absorption. So that's why certain medications will dictate, hey, take this with food or milk, or just take it on an empty stomach. So that's what's driving it. We do make some vitamins. We make B and K in the intestines. I think of that as Burger King. And we also make vitamin D where?
Skin.
Yeah, make it in the skin exposed to sunlight. So we do have the ability to make some of our vitamins, just not all of them. You know, some animals make vitamin C. We don't. We get it from our citrus fruits and potatoes and things of that sort. So not all of our vitamins are something that we can manufacture. All right, so a lot of information there. What I would do on page, 89, I would look at what the food group is, where we first begin the breakdown, what enzymes act on it. So if I said to you, okay, where does carb digestion begin? What organ would you name?
The mouth.
The mouth, good. If I talked about pepsin, you would say, oh, that hydrolyzes proteins, good. If we talk about something like fat, what two things come to mind?
The mouth and small intestine.
Mouth and small intestine and bile and lipase, right. So you want to kind of put these terms in like a mental bag so you've got these terms that kind of match and go together. Okay, so that should do it for page 89. How about questions so far on that page? Yeah, you could add in skin. Yeah, that's a great memory jogger. Like last Thursday. We'll soon be talking about poop, so that may kill the appetite.
Oh, God. All right, yeah. I'm ready.
We've already been talking about it so many times.
Yeah. We're making it, so we're in the process.
Yes.
You know, when you have vomiting and diarrhea, we oftentimes get concerned about electrolyte loss. And that's because the small intestine is the location for electrolyte absorption. You know, electrolytes are important for maintaining osmosis, maintaining fluid compartments. Electrolytes are important for muscle and nerve contractions, you know, impulse transmissions. So there's a very good reason that we do get concerned about electrolyte imbalances if we've had, say, a case of vomiting and diarrhea. You probably know this, but I'll mention it anyway. If you vomit, you're pulling contents from your stomach and occasionally from your small intestine.
Ew.
Yeah. So if you happen to be pulling something up that looks greenish yellow, brownish colored, it's not poop, it's actually bile. And the bile should be coming into your small intestine from your gallbladder or liver, but you know, if you're vomiting and you're dry heaving, it can actually start pulling from your small intestine up as well. So I don't know, that may kill your appetite for food at this point.
Hasn't done it yet.
Not yet. So let's talk about some of the important electrolytes that are normally absorbed in the small intestine. We've got iron and calcium there that are absorbed if needed. Now, we already know about calcium. Which hormone helps us increase blood calcium levels?
Parathyroid,
good. So parathyroid actually inserts calcium channels into your small intestine and helps you to maintain more calcium absorption from the foods that you eat. You know, if you don't absorb it, it just goes out with your feces, so, you know, we just don't take in extra unless we need it. Also important is sodium absorption in the small intestine, but it is actually a vehicle or a driver for absorbing other things like glucose and amino acids. Why is it important for us to absorb glucose in the wall of our small intestine?
Keep our sugar levels normal.
Yeah, keep your sugar levels normal. And what is sugar used to make? ATP. Yeah. And what do amino acids need? What do we build with those?
Proteins.
So we're actually pulling two very important things into our bloodstream, glucose and amino acids, but we put them with sodium reabsorption. So we pull sodium in along with glucose and amino acids. Likewise, potassium may also be absorbed here by facilitated diffusion. So, you know, you've heard of a lot of these before. We're going to further explore why they're important. Sodium is common in your extracellular fluids. Potassium is common in your intracellular fluids. So we're really making sure that we get all the electrolytes into our body that we need here in the small intestine. All right, so taking this full circle, we've talked about osmotic pressure back in the blood vessels chapter. If you don't absorb these electrolytes here in the small intestine, what happens to your osmotic pressure?
It decreases.
Now, is osmotic pressure the one responsible for pushing fluids out of a capillary or pulling them back in?
It's pulling them back in. No, push.
It's for pulling them.
Pulling them. Who's the pusher?
It's the blood pressure.
Blood pressure, yeah. Hydrostatic or blood pressure is the pushy pressure. Osmotic pressure pulls fluids from your interstitial space back into the capillary. Let's say that you've had a case of vomiting and diarrhea and you've lost a lot of these electrolytes from your body. They never got in the bloodstream in the first place. All right, so what is your problem? Too many fluids in the interstitial space or more fluids being pulled out of the interstitial space?
Too many in the interstitial space.
And if you don't have the electrolytes, they're all going out into the interstitial.
They're all going out in the interstitial space. Why can't you pull them back in?
Because you lack those electrolytes. You vomited them out.
You vomited them out. You've lost the electrolytes. So your osmotic pressure is decreased. So this doesn't make sense at all, does it?
No.
When you vomit and have diarrhea, you think you're dehydrated, right? Okay? So.
You're overhydrated in a sense.
But you're overhydrated in a sense, right? So
you're holding on to the fluids in your body.
You're holding on to the fluids, exactly.
Is that why they usually tell you to drink Gatorade?
Yeah.
Because it has a lot of electrolytes and it's basically going in through a liquid. It's probably a lot faster than
right.
going through digestion.
And you're more likely to get some of it absorbed, you know. You don't have to wait for it to be ground up and digested. Exactly. So if you don't drink Gatorade when you're having vomiting and diarrhea, then where do those fluids stay for a while?
In your interstitial.
Interstitial, yeah. And so you are, in fact, swollen when you have something like diarrhea. Believe it or not, you get swollen until you can retain, you know, nutrients through eating properly once again. So I know that makes absolutely no sense that you would swell with fluids when you are having diarrhea, but that's, in fact, what happens. You need the electrolytes here to pull those fluids back from the interstitial space into your bloodstream.
That's why they do the thing on your hand to see if your skin snaps back.
Exactly, yeah, because if you're dehydrated, it tense up and stays tinted, yeah.
And that's just your body trying to protect itself?
It may be, but it's just the nature of the way the electrolytes and the fluids behave. But yeah, in effect, it helps you retain fluids. So this is actually getting your brain in gear for fluid electrolyte balance. It's coming up in two chapters. So we'll come back and talk once again about how vomiting and diarrhea influence us because we're robbing ourselves of these electrolytes.
Would that increase in
how diuretic hormone also? Probably aldosterone. Yeah, because then we need to retain more sodium. It's not the water that we want to retain so much as the sodium that we want to retain. Yeah. Hey, speaking of water, we also do get a lot of the fluids in our bodies from what we drink. So we do retain fluids from foods and drink. We also get a lot of fluids pumped into our digestive tract simply for the process of digestion. So we retain fluids from the saliva, our stomach juices, and intestinal juices. And I just wanted to show you how much fluid we're pumping every day into our digestive tract to break down foods. Thankfully, about 90-something percent of it is retained back into our bloodstream. You know, it's a liter of fluid in the saliva that we secrete per day. We make about a liter of gastric juices. We make about a liter of pancreatic secretions, 2 liters of small intestine secretions. So, you know, we only lose about 1% of the fluids in our digestive tract per day to feces. What happens to the other 99% of these fluids?
Absorb
them, yeah. So we are really efficient at hanging on to our fluids, and we only lose about 1% in our feces per day. So the majority of our fluids, we're going to find out, actually escape our bodies through our urine, not through our feces. All right, so that should do it for small intestine. How about questions there?
Doesn't matter how you pronounce duodenum.
I don't think so. I've heard duodenum and duodenum, yeah.
Because okay. My mom was like, what did you say? And I'm like, I think you can pronounce it either way.
Mom. Yeah. I think it's just personal preference.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love
that
Matt says duodenum. I'm like, you're not wearing 2 pairs of jeans. So I get mad.
That makes sense.
Yes. Duodenum.
No.
I like duodenum. Actually.
Duodenum sounds more sophisticated. I know.
Right.
Yeah. Duodenum, yeah.
Say last morning.
Just like versus denouement is denouement. Like denouement sounds more.
That's where you put your emphasis, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But your bass is on the Ross level.
Duo denim, I like that. Two pairs of jeans. Okay, so how is the large intestine different from the small intestine? Good. Bigger diameter, shorter in length. It's about 5 feet in length as opposed to 20 feet for your small intestine. Yes, so quite a bit shorter. And it has a little waistband that cinches it up and makes it smaller in terms of a living person with muscle tone. That waistband is actually longitudinal muscle. You can see it actually on the outer side here, and that is so tight in cinching up your small or large intestine, rather, that it makes these little pockets. They are called? Yeah, hostra, good. All right, so kind of a cool concept there that we have a waistband around our large intestine. There are three main regions here. You have a cecum on the right-hand side that hooks to your small intestine via the ileocecal sphincter, okay, right in this area. We've got an appendix that hangs off as a blind pouch. And the weird thing is, look at this. The intestine actually, or the appendix rather, get you the right picture. Oh, I don't have it up here. The appendix actually has the same four layers as you would expect to see for any other part of the large intestine. So it's constructed as if it belongs to the rest of the structures there. So we think it has some function in immunity, has bacteria, we know that. And those bacteria, we hope to help reduce our infection rate of, you know, other things coming into our bloodstream. The next main region is a colon, and it's got an ascending portion with a flexure here called?
The hepatic flexure.
Good. We've got a transverse colon and another flexure known as?
Splenic
flexure. Descending leads to an S-shaped curve.
Sigmoid.
And then finally, the rectum is the last portion, or terminal portion, of your large intestine. This picture kills me because, you know, it's made by Atom, which is a software that produces anatomy and physiology content, and they didn't put the anus on here because they technically consider that as a terminal portion of your large intestine. So it looks like the rectum just fades off into nothing. Yeah, we know better. We know that there's actually a set of sphincters in the anal region. One of them is an external sphincter composed of skeletal muscle, and the other one is an internal sphincter composed of smooth muscle. Which one can we control?
The skeletal.
The skeletal, yeah, the external sphincter. So that means the internal involuntary sphincter is one that we do not control. It is our job to keep the external sphincters closed. Okay, and of course, we are the ones that regulate whether or not we open those external sphincters or keep them shut. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Okay, so that takes us over to the top of page 91. Let's talk about the anal canal up there at the top of 91 for just a moment. Because the anal canal is the exit route for feces, and we're not talking food anymore, we're talking feces. This stuff is done. We've absorbed all the nutrients we can out of it. We're done with it by the time it gets to this point. There are valves in here that point upward inside the anal canal, and that is to prevent the passage of gas and feces at the same time. Okay, so that's a very beneficial thing to have. There are columns in here that expedite the exit of the feces if we make it that far. And then we've also got, you know, those sphincters that we talked about here that help to regulate the passage of feces. By the time you get to this point in the digestive tract, we are looking at stratified squamous epithelium. Up until this point, both small and large intestine have a lining made up of simple what?
Columnar.
Yep, got a simple columnar lining. But there's an abrasion factor here, so we have to make sure that we have a thickness to the lining. Therefore, there is stratified squamous once you reach this far along.
So you said those little ridges are so, you know, so gas and come out at the same time?
Right. If you prefer to set gas-free, then you can let those anal valves do their jobs. They're supposed to keep the feces from exiting. But if feces have made it this far, then you're probably looking at a bowel movement anyway.
Right.
Normally the rectum and anal canal are empty unless you are ready for a bowel movement. Let's see, absorption is limited here to water absorption. We're not really looking at nutrient absorption, and if I show you the lining of the large intestine, it's not as pretty and fancy as the small intestine. We're looking mainly at some pretty rough-looking villi, and that is to help us maintain water absorption here. Now, the amount of time that food spends or feces spend here will drive how much water you can absorb from the large intestine. If food or feces spend a long time here, you're going to dry the heck out of this stuff. And what can happen?
Constipation.
Constipation, right. And of course, if there's a quick exit through this route, then we're looking at not enough water absorbed, and then we're looking at
diarrhea,
right? And we can lead that to dehydration. Bacteria are also present here. In fact, bacteria are present throughout our bodies. But there's a large number here in the large intestine that we consider to be our own flora and fauna. There has been research done. I think this is kind of an interesting take. You know, nowadays a lot more babies are born by C-section than, say, 50 years ago, or certainly more than 100 years ago. So C-sections lift babies out of the uterus and don't let them pass through the vaginal canal of the mother. There's been some research that shows if you let the baby's head pass through the vaginal canal, those bacteria present will help to colonize the baby's own gut, and that helps to reduce chances of things like colic. You know, some mothers can't have a vaginal birth. Maybe there's problems that are going on that she has to have a C-section. But it's interesting to note that the research tends to point toward, you know, a vaginal birth to encourage the colonization of the baby's body with bacteria from mom's body. That's a nasty thought, but, you know, nonetheless, these bacteria are important for helping us to make vitamins. They help us to fight off bad bacteria in the large intestine. We have E. coli. You know, that's a bad bacteria, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that we have good bacteria there is to keep the bad bacteria in check. And we also have that ileocecal sphincter that prevents bad bacteria like E. coli from passing further up into our digestive tract, like into our small intestine. You can get really sick if you've got E. coli in your small intestine. What is your small intestine likely going to do with that bacteria?
Absorb it.
Yeah. So it's in your bloodstream, and now you don't have a localized problem. You have a systemic problem. So, yeah, there's a very good set of bacteria that live here in our large intestine. When we poop them out every day with our feces, you know, dead ones that are removed. But, yeah, there's a very good set of bacteria that live here that are symbiotic with what we're doing. So let's talk about feces for just a moment. What do feces contain?
Water.
Good. Undigested food, mucus, water, of course, bacteria. Yeah, bile salts, good. Just want to mention something about the color of feces. That brown color comes from the breakdown of bile. Bile is normally yellowish, greenish in color. But the process of traveling through your intestines allows it to break down and turn brown. If you have a bowel movement soon after eating, you may notice the feces have more of a greenish yellow tint to them. That's because you didn't have an opportunity to break down the bile as it passed through your intestines. So if people notice their feces turn a lighter color, kind of like the color of these walls, that may actually indicate that there's not enough bile being secreted by the liver and gallbladder. So the color of our feces actually is very indicative of the health of our liver, gallbladder, and our intestines. If you have light-colored stools like the walls in this room, that indicates that we should have our liver and gallbladder looked at. There's probably not enough bile coming into the small intestine. Now, if that's the case, not enough bile, what happens to the fatty foods in your small intestine?
It's not able to be broken down or absorbed.
Don't break it down, don't absorb it. So you expect to have feces that float. Yep. So there's a lot going on there that we can tell just by looking at stool. And so defecation is, of course, the main function here for our large intestine. That's to remove these undigestible food waste. So I'd like to talk to you about the motility process next. There's three things that lead to the production of a bowel movement. One of them is called a hostral contraction. So what were hostra?
Little speed bumps,
little pockets there. And so all you do with a hostral contraction is move feces from one hostra to the next hostra. Okay, that's all we accomplish. Okay, so the function there on your worksheet is to move feces from one hostra to the next hostra. Move feces from one hostra to the next hostra. Hey, if you had to rely on hostral contractions to produce a bowel movement, we'd be waiting a while, wouldn't we? So we're only moving, you know, about one hostra at a time every 30 minutes. So this is not going to accomplish a bowel movement on its own. What's going to help you accomplish a bowel movement is this: a defecation reflex that evolves from a mass movement. You have a mass movement about 3 to 4 times per day. That's because we eat roughly 3 to 4 times per day. Every time you put food into your stomach, the stomach initiates waves of peristalsis. Those waves of peristalsis travel down to your large intestine, and the waste in here are pushed along, not from hostra to hostra, but we're propelling them in mass toward your rectum. So if your rectum fills with feces, you'll then have an urge to have a bowel movement. But if there's not enough food in the large intestine or feces, then the rectum doesn't fill and you don't have an urge to have a bowel movement. Some people have mass movements multiple times a day that result in a defecation reflex, and others may not have a reflex evolve maybe more than every several days. Okay? So the mass movement's function is to propel feces toward the rectum. Okay, function of the mass movement is to propel feces toward the rectum. So talking about defecation is going to take more than about a minute or so, so I'd like to save that until class on Thursday. We'll pick back up here, and our goal on Thursday is to finish up this chapter.